Now here is the Mole's Dan Jaffe talking to Michael Mahaffey about ways to rethink the housing crisis.
A growing crisis of housing and rental affordability, gentrification, displacement, and houselessness is everywhere in the news in Portland, many cities around the U.S., and worldwide. Here in Portland, at the Oregon State Legislature, major deregulatory policy changes, including Portland's residential infill plan and state legislation, including Oregon House Bill 2001, which would mandate that cities allow multi-unit housing on any residential lot, are moving forward and generating plenty of controversy and polarization. Joining us is Michael Mahaffey. He is an urban researcher at the KTH University in Stockholm, Sweden. He's the co-host of a blog, livableportland.org, and he is an urban designer and development consultant who's been active in Portland area planning and building since the early 90s. This is the second part of our two-part discussion. If you missed the first part, you can find it on the Old Mole Variety Hours page on the KBOO website. Welcome back, Michael Mahaffey.
Thank you, Dan.
Let's turn to some of the specific proposals that are on the table right now that are generating a lot of heat and a lot of controversy in Portland and at the state level that involve what you call deregulatory upzoning. Maybe first of all, what do you mean by that term, deregulatory upzoning?
Well, it's ironic that, you know, in Portland and in Oregon, we think of ourselves as a progressive state, and yet really the agenda right now is very much on deregulation, as you said, and on easing the restrictions on building more units, which is being done for an understandable reason. The concern is that there's a limited supply, and therefore we need to make it easier to build supply so that it will better meet demand and so that prices will come down. But as I was saying in the previous discussion, unfortunately, we're dealing with a complex system that has a lot of elements that are interacting with each other. And that kind of simplistic approach, what I call build, baby, build, really doesn't work. The evidence, the research evidence, I think, shows pretty clearly it's one of the things that you need to do. But of course, the question is, what are you deregulating? And are you actually damaging the public realm, the urban commons that we all share and that we all treasure? Are you damaging our historic assets? Are we getting demolitions? Are we getting actually the problem, making the problem worse, not better, in terms of affordability and equity and sustainability? And I think the evidence is very disturbing that these kinds of command and control approaches that in this case are command and control to deregulate, ironically enough, but that's what the agenda is. And I think the danger is that that's going to be counterproductive, that we're actually going to make these problems worse.
Let's get into some of the details. There is a movement nationally among some cities to essentially end single-family residential zoning with the goal of increasing density in urban neighborhoods, and with the added sort of argument that single-family residential zones are a legacy of the U.S. Racist past, that they coincide with an urban form that is connected to redlining and residential segregation. Cities like Minneapolis recently ended single-family zoning across the entire city, are now allowing duplexes and triplexes to be built on any lot. And then in Portland, there is a proposal called the Residential Infill Proposal, RIP, which began, I think, about 5 years ago under Mayor Charlie Hales. At the time, it was a proposal to address the concerns about demolition of existing housing to build very large McMansions, one-for-one replacements that were in many cases towering over nearby houses, but also were not adding additional units. It sort of morphed over the years into something different. Second iteration was a proposal to allow duplexes on any lot in about 60% of the area of Portland. And then it morphed yet again in the last year or so, as it went through the Portland Planning and Sustainability Commission, into a proposal to allow up to fourplexes on any lot anywhere in the city, virtually anywhere in the city, 96% of the city's land. It barely passed out of that Planning and Sustainability Commission. I think it won by one vote, and it's now going to be heading toward the city council. How should we think about a proposal like the residential infill proposal?
As I said before, we're dealing with a complex system, right? So we have to be very careful to acknowledge some of the factors that are true. There are grains of truth and maybe more than grains of truth in what some of the proponents are saying. So, yes, residential zoning has a past that's bound up with the racist history of many cities. That said, it doesn't follow automatically that the way to deal with the problem is to, you know, shove new housing down existing residents' throat. It may or may not solve the problem. And what it is more likely to do, in my opinion, is to create a political blowback that is incredibly divisive and incredibly destructive of our civic discourse in Portland and our ability to solve problems. My background is partly in public involvement and in working with neighbors, and I've always found that the best way to do that is to be respectful of people's concerns. Mm-hmm. They may be overreacting. They may be have motivations that I find troubling, but they are citizens just like we are, and I think we have to respect the democratic process and the need to be part of a civic discourse, a civic debate.
Let's talk about sort of this, the kind of cultural politics of this set of issues of this moment. I think it's fair to say that the atmosphere in Portland and in other cities that have addressed these issues, including Seattle and elsewhere around these proposed policy changes, has become very polarized and even hostile in some cases. There have been sort of ad hominem attacks by some politicians, by many sort of pro-density, pro-growth groups against neighborhood and resident activists. So I guess I feel like I need to ask, how much, if any, truth is there to these characterizations? Are some neighborhood residents unrealistically clinging to a dated white picket fence vision of single-family neighborhoods?
I find that characterization troubling because, again, I think we have to work together to solve our problems. And I think most people in Portland are genuinely interested in a more equitable city, a fairer city for everybody. And I think we've got to get back to that place where we're all working together on these issues and actually making progress. And we're not going to make progress if we're, you know, acting like Donald Trump, attacking everyone and you know, creating more and more division. And, you know, we were talking in the previously about the irony of Portland as a city that fancies itself a progressive city and Oregon a progressive state. And yet, in many ways, I think we're taking chapters out of Donald Trump's playbook. And in fact, there are people who are very eager to see the growth promoted in Portland to advance this argument about what I call build, baby, build, that we need to just deregulate and allow lots of housing and so on, who are, in fact, prominent supporters of Donald Trump. My colleague Clyde Holland, who is with Holland Development Group, I know Clyde and consider him a friend, but I absolutely disagree with him about his support for Donald Trump. And yet he's one of the major influences with the 1,000 Friends of Oregon right now. So what does that say about where we are politically?
And 1,000 Friends of Oregon has taken a strong stand in support of both the city residential infill project and the state bills to increase housing density.
That's right. That's right. And so 1,000 Friends of Oregon and Portland for Everyone, and there are a number of other groups that are allied. And I think in the main, they are very sincere and well-meaning. But I think we really have to be careful about these sort of Trojan horses, if you will, these very convenient rationalizations for what is, at the end of the day, financial self-interest in the main, or at least financial self-interest deeply coloring and affecting, if not outright corrupting, our judgments on these issues. So going back to 1,000 Friends for a moment, I think they've bought into the argument, which I think is entirely wrong on the evidence, that overbuilding in the core is going to save farmland and save wilderness because it's, you know, you build tall buildings and then you don't need to sprawl out into the suburbs. But, you know, the numbers just don't confirm that. There's very small amounts of additional units that you get in the core relative to the entire region. The way to really build lots of units that are more affordable is to go to the places where they're already low density and do infill projects in a lot of the places where there are great opportunities for that. The Grayfield malls, the dead malls and dying malls, the parking lots, the wasted medians and rights of way and areas that they're a little tricky to unlock for development, but they are great opportunities, I think, for the region to create more sort of complete communities in these other much larger areas of the region rather than going into the core and forcing a density down people's throats and creating this unnecessarily divisive atmosphere that we have.
I want to stick with this issue for just a second. The argument that we hear from a lot of the promoters of these proposals to densify and to dramatically densify in a lot of the urban residential neighborhoods is that keeping the current zoning effectively locks diverse populations out of access to certain neighborhoods. Portland, for example, is only counting on rezoning residential neighborhoods to take up about 20% of all the growth in new residents that it's counting on. Yet the argument that accompanies it is one of racial and economic justice, that it is unjust to exclude or to not allow new populations, new kinds of family configurations, to have access to neighborhoods that are sort of residential neighborhoods that are portrayed as sort of being the metaphor of gated communities is used and enclaves. So I guess I want to ask in this way, is it possible to be genuinely anti-racist, genuinely pro-social justice, pro-economic justice, and also at the same time challenge the direction that planning and zoning policy is taking in places like Portland? And if so, what would that look like?
Well, yes, absolutely. And I would put myself in that category. I mean, I think the idea that, you know, you need to change the zoning in order to promote greater equity rests on a huge assumption. And that is that by changing the zoning, you're going to actually create lower cost housing and housing that more people can afford. Of course, I'm not saying that we shouldn't look at our zoning and look at what my friend Patrick Condon at the University of British Columbia calls gentle densification. There are ways to create gentle densification in existing neighborhoods. There are ways to work with the neighborhoods and the neighborhood associations. Another dimension of this that troubles me greatly is the sort of dismantling of the neighborhood associations, blaming them as NIMBYs, and instead of engaging them and challenging them to be more constructive and more representative of their populations, which I think they can be and should be. The key is really that we have to do it judiciously, and we have to do it as part of a true democratic process, which is unfortunately not what's happening.
Following on that discussion of democratic process, you mentioned the urbanist Jane Jacobs last week in our discussion. What do you think Jane Jacobs' vision, her ideas and her battles, what lessons do you think those have to offer us today as far as guiding us in the decisions that we need to make here in Portland and in Oregon?
Incredibly relevant, I think. You know, Jacobs was somebody who did talk about gentrification, and some people aren't aware of that, and they sort of criticize her for not having dealt with gentrification and race and those issues. But she actually did, and she made some very important points. And I'm really, a lot of my thinking is greatly affected by her observations about the dynamics of cities, the kind of problem a city is, as she put it. And if we don't get our head around that and we don't work on the city in that way, we're going to continue to make terrible mistakes, as we have. We need to have a much more distributed, polycentric approach to the region. And if we do that, and if we use tools, specific tool, regulatory tools, tax tools, other tools to restrict the influence of capital, as we were talking about last time, and the protections for existing homeowners and renters, and tools in a kind of strategic approach, then we can make some headway on our challenges. But I think the approach that we're taking right now is actually compounding our problems, not making them better.
Michael Mahaffey, what about these alternative models that you're sort of alluding to? I'd like to get a little bit more into this. What are some alternative models that would genuinely address the gentrification problem, the lack of affordability and equity, without opening the door to, say, unlimited demolition across swaths of an entire city, are there ways to provide the needed housing that also sort of partly or fully decommodify land and housing instead of going further into the hyper-commodification that we talked about last week?
Well, again, you know, you have to be careful even in talking about this of, you know, silver bullet thinking. I think we need something more like silver buckshot, if you will, and that we need to look at a number of tools. For example, damping down this speculative real estate bubble that we're in, which is going to push us into another 2008 if we're not careful, you know, damping down the effect of capital coming into the city, having taxation tools, restrictions, frankly, on foreign investments, as Vancouver has now done. There are tools to unlock underutilized sites. I was talking earlier about in the suburbs, there are many examples of wasted land all over the place, parking lots that are underused, dead and dying malls, excess medians and other spaces. The density of Portland in the suburbs is incredibly low. And yet, here we have the irony that the city is wanting to go into places like Goose Hollow, which is one of the highest densities in all of Oregon, and build there instead of going to the places where that really need the density. It's sort of like you're taking the places that are already working and you're going to break them instead of going to the places that, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, as they say. As for a couple of other tools, I mentioned my friend Patrick Condon, who talked about gentle densification. And yes, I think maybe accessory dwellings and complementary infill development that is supported by the neighbors. And I've seen that happen. We've had that with the Rinco Station I mentioned earlier. I think it's fair to have targeted protections for existing renters and owners and aggressive help for the homeless. We're falling down on that responsibility, and we need to do a much better job of that. I think we can take a much more constructive win-win kind of approach. You were referring to Yes in My Backyard, and I have friends who are part of that movement. I think they're wrong in the sense that they're too heavy-handed about it. They're wanting to fight with existing neighbors and force them to accept density. What I'd like to see is something that you might call Quimby, a nice name for Portland, quality in my backyard. People who in the neighborhoods, in the existing neighborhoods, will support infill development if it makes their neighborhood more beautiful, more livable, gives them more assets to, you know, cafes and other things that they might actually enjoy having around them. And I've seen that happen. So I'm not just, you know, imagining something idealistic.
And finally, then, well, to end, let's talk about that note of democracy and citizen participation. The critical geographer David Harvey is famous for talking about this idea of the right to the city, and many others have written about it. You mentioned Jane Jacobs's vision. That was one involving active grassroots participation in the democratic processes. You've touched on this already a little bit, but what can other cities' failures or successes offer Portland in terms of lessons around how to preserve that vibrant grassroots democracy?
The point that you made about the right to the city is a really important one, because it's not just a matter of giving people something that they can then go in and inhabit. It's about empowering people to co-produce the city. You know, this is really, I think, what's under threat with the overcapitalization of our cities and the privatization of public spaces. Sometimes that's not literally privatization, but it's domination of the public spaces by private interests so that people don't feel welcome there. And you mentioned Jane Jacobs, she made this point in a very powerful way, that we're all the co-producers of the city. And she famously said that cities have the capability of providing something for everybody only because and only when they're created by everybody. So I think that's what we've got to aim for in our thinking about our urban policies and our public realm.
Well, in closing, how can listeners who want to learn more about these issues or concerned about these issues get more information or get involved, plug into efforts to have a broader dialogue?
Well, I talked about the neighborhood associations, and I think we're in a difficult situation right now because the neighborhood association system is rather dysfunctional. But I do believe that if we're going to have true participatory democracy in Portland, we need to empower our neighborhood associations, and we all need to join our neighborhood associations, get involved, engage in these issues, and be part of a grassroots process of city governance.
And of course, your blog.
Well, right, and I will modestly give the URL. It's livableportland.org, and we do talk about some of these and provide some links and so on.
Well, that's it for today. I've been speaking with Michael Mahaffey. He's a researcher at the KTH University in Stockholm, Sweden, the executive director of the Systasis Foundation. And if you missed the first part of our conversation last week, you can find it on the Old Mole Variety Hours page on the KBOO website. Michael Mahaffey, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Dan.